Hey, what's up, everyone? I'm your host, Dr. Mills. I'm a physical therapist and strength and conditioning coach and fitness coach. Today, we're back. We're back in action. Joey and I sat down with Beth Bacon. Beth is a national level master's weightlifter, as well as co-owner of Maui Athletics. That is a fitness, weightlifting, and nutrition counseling company. We got to sit down with Beth. It was a super great conversation. We chatted about programming. Programming was the bulk of what we talked about. And you know, she talks about her personal experiences with programming and managing volume and intensity with, you know, being a youngin to now a what she calls super old. She's like 38. She's not old at all. She's spring chicken. But you know, her ability to recover has changed, right? And she talked about, you know, her background in bodybuilding and fitness competitions and how that has, you know, kind of spurned on her ability to use appropriate movement patterns when doing weightlifting. So we talked about that. We talked about, you know, What does programming look like for a fitness professional? And then, of course, we just chopped it up about miscellaneous things. So hope you enjoy, and we'll get right to it. Thanks for listening.
If you're a barbell coach or trainer interested in learning more about the mechanics of lifting, or struggles with programming a client through pain to peak performance, or communication skills to effectively gather intel on your client's previous injuries, this podcast is for you. The Alinea Coaches Podcast exists to elevate strength and conditioning coaches, as well as personal trainers to the highest degree. Co-hosts and barbell coaches turned doctors of physical therapy, William Mills and Joey Rosie, interview coaches and trainers from around the globe on improving mechanics, communication, and programming to better serve their clients as a new line of fitness professional.
All right, so welcome back, everyone. Today we're going to be chatting. Joey's on the podcast today. What's up, Joey? But today we're going to be chatting with Beth Bacon. She is a personal trainer and strength coach, as well as a weightlifter. I think she does competitive stuff, right?
Yes, I
do. How long have you been competing?
I've been competing in weightlifting now for about 2 to 3 years. So I went to Masters Worlds last year and broke an American record in the snatch.
Nice.
I came in second place total, so I was really happy with that. Old lady lifting.
That's awesome.
Masters for weightlifting starts 35?
35, yeah. Yep.
Mm-hmm. I have a buddy who, so he's a farmer, and he owns his own butcher shop in Baton Rouge, and he's thought about doing master's weightlifting. I think he's 34. And I was like, dude, let's do it. We'll get your old man strength up. I think he's like 155, but pound for pound, he's super, super strong. So I think he would be competitive if we got his skills up, but, yeah, he's been very busy with Corona stuff. So, but yeah, So how did you tell us a little bit about how you got into weightlifting as your own athlete, right? How you got into that, as well as how you got into training people.
Okay. So weightlifting I got into through CrossFit. I feel like that's how a lot of people these days are kind of getting into it.
Yeah.
I started CrossFit back in 2011, 2012, when it was still like,
so you're an OG.
Actual CrossFit, yeah.
Did you have five finger toe shoes?
No, I didn't. I didn't go down the Vibram route. I wasn't that much into it, but I did do all the paleo stuff and everything.
Perfect.
I was a competitive CrossFitter. I was actually on a team that qualified for regionals twice. And so I did that until about 2016, 17, and that's about when I switched over full time to weightlifting. Mm-hmm. Weightlifting was always what I loved the most about CrossFit. I don't know if it's because it's, you know, there's such highly involved skills and all the technical aspects of it. There's always something that you can get better at. And as a lifetime, I've played sports since I was 4 years old. As a lifetime athlete, the striving for perfection, but knowing that you're really kind of never going to get there, is actually what drives me. I don't mind not being completely perfect at the clean and jerk or completely perfect at the snatch, because it's always going to give me something to work on. When I go into the gym, there's always an objective for the training that day, whether it be a specific cue or just trying to fix part of my pull. There's always something that you can be working on, and that's really what I love about it. It's a sort of lifetime craft for me, yeah, more than anything else. Yeah. And then for the training aspect of it, I was a competitive figure competitor back in 2008, 2009, 2010. So I did like 4 or 5 figure competitions and hated it. Just absolutely, absolutely hated it. Everything from dieting to the awful tanner that they put on you.
Yeah. I was going to ask, how was the cut?
It would depend on the coach. So, yeah. And this is kind of where I can get on my soapbox if I'm not careful, but.
Oh, you could totally, that's what this
podcast is an open space
is for.
There's not all coaches are created equal when it comes to contest prep for bodybuilding. You've got the very old school sort of bro mentality of you have to eat, you know, tilapia and asparagus from breakfast all the way through dinner. And I had a coach like that, and I wanted to jump off a bridge.
I'm gagging a little bit.
Yeah, eating tilapia at like 7 o'clock in the morning it's really special. Really special. And then I had coaches who were like, they did not subscribe to that bro diet mentality at all. It was more of a, a macro approach and sticking to certain number of protein and then just kind of hitting calories, like not really even looking at carbohydrates and fats as much as just keep it to this calorie range and you'll be okay. And I mean, my physique looked the same no matter what I did. Mm-hmm. So there is a lot to support that, the macro approach for cutting calories and all that jazz. But I really did enjoy the actual bodybuilding part of it and going into the gym and, really focusing on the muscle contraction and, your tempo and all that kind of stuff. You're really sort of striving for perfection with each workout that you do. And I really liked that. And a lot of people will ask me all the time, how did you get your shoulders to look the way that they do? How does your back look like that? And a lot of it is not from CrossFit, it's not from weightlifting, it's from the years and years and years of bodybuilding that I did. And to this day, I still keep all that type of stuff in my training. A lot of my
accessories.
My bodybuilding stuff. So I sort of got into the whole coaching people through that experience. I started to see that there were a lot of people that would ask me questions about what I was eating, how I was training, and I liked it. I liked helping people kind of change their bodies and change their lives, but I never had the means really, or the ability or the time to do it full time up until a few years ago. So I originally was working for a company called Lean Bodies Consulting, which is based in Canada. I think there's about 4 coaches left on the team. There were 7 of us at the time. And they had all the materials, right? So all of the documents that you give to your clients and that kind of thing, they had all of that done and available. And that really is what takes you as a coach the most upfront time to put those materials together. So that gave me the ability to actually do it and get clients and start to coach clients. And then I left them after about 2.5 years, and my husband and I started our own company called Maui Athletics, and we've been on the ground running now for about 1.5 to 2 years on our own.
Cool.
Yeah.
So the one that you were working for with the Lean Bodies, was that mostly nutrition coaching, or was it nutrition as well as exercise?
Nutrition as well as exercise. And the clients run the gamut of people who just are physique based and are just doing sort of, bro stuff that you would classify bro stuff in the gym. I had CrossFitters, I had weightlifters, I had some powerlifters. So my clients really sort of run the gamut of what it is that they like to do for exercise.
Gotcha. Cool. So since then, working with your husband, do you still work with a wide array of people, or have you focused on niching down a little bit more?
Yeah, we still work with a very wide array of clients. I have this sort of the same type of thing that I was dealing with when I was at Lean Bodies Consulting with competitive weightlifters, non-competitive weightlifters, CrossFitters, non-competitive CrossFitters. My husband has his USAPL, so he really deals more with our powerlifting clients, either people that really just like the big three and that's really what they want their main focus to be on their training, or if they're a competitive powerlifter. So I tend to gravitate towards the CrossFitters and the weightlifters, and he tends to gravitate towards the powerlifters. And then we both do...
It's like me and Joey.
We both do the physique-oriented people, too, who just want to do either body part splits or are really just more sort of bodybuilding-focused.
Gotcha.
Yeah, I think, Joey's so much
basically
of what you
like
said.
My husband at this point, so it sounds like we're in the same boat.
It's so true, because I actually, what you're saying, I'm like, wow, this is literally the same exact story I had, except I didn't go down the CrossFit weightlifting route. I went to powerlifting route. Myself, and then later, I connected with Will, and a lot of what we thought was all the same, except he was still out in weightlifting land, and I was over in the meathead shack with the powerlifters. It's absolutely crazy, and a lot of people ask me when you're competing or when you're training. I think bodybuilding really sets a lot of stage for people, and it really helps build a foundation for any of the barbell lifts or any of the barbell movements, because you learn so much about speed, tempo, control. When bodybuilding's objective, like as most people know, is not really the weight on the bar, but how you look and how the muscle contracts and, how full it is, et cetera. And I think it really just gives so many people more reps with movements. Therefore, they get more control, they get more comfortable, and it really does build a solid foundation.
I totally agree with that. And I think I have found that the people who come from that bodybuilding background also just have so much more body awareness. So when you're talking about using specific muscles, like especially in weightlifting, you're talking about using the lats to hold the bar back. The amount of people that don't know how to actually contract their lats is astonishing to me, that people don't understand that. They have no awareness of when their lats are fired versus when they're not. And having that background, because you do have to focus on all of those contractions and, like you said, the tempo, you have a much better awareness of what your body is actually doing in the context of the lift. And it really does end up paying dividends, I think, in the long run.
Yeah, absolutely. They're definitely the easier ones. As a therapist, they're the easier ones to work with than somebody who isn't. Like you said, just because of their kinesthetic awareness, their body awareness. Oh, add your lats. I mean, they get it.
Yep.
Where some other people, you have to sit in there, touch, cue, point, move and shift and everything. And there's so many aspects to it. So, I mean, you're definitely right on with that one.
Yeah. I think Joey's point about the bodybuilding and just practicing reps, that's a conversation that I've been getting into a lot with my patients, in the sense of, if you're working on something and there was pain involved, there's solid research to show that people move differently when they're in pain. So like deciphering and reintroducing a movement, the conversation has been, I don't really care if you feel like it's perfect whenever you're doing it, right? I just want you to be able to feel what you should be feeling versus what you shouldn't be. And then view what you're doing, like your set is practice, right? So with each rep, you're practicing the rep. It's not, you have to do it all perfectly. It's just practice throughout, which is how motor learning takes place anyway, right? So if the goal is to normalize a movement that was previously painful, that's where my conversations have been going with my patients recently, which is cool because it shows that the same principles, like in our world of physical therapy, prior to Joey and I's like age group getting into physical therapy, we were like 2 to 4 years on the end of a shift where physical therapists don't just treat runners, and like physical therapists can actually lift, because the outpatient physical therapy world prior to us, you know, the physical therapists did a horrible job of like really associating themselves with CrossFitters whenever I got into CrossFit as a college student. And that's a whole other soapbox with Cairo versus PT.
Yeah, I mean, that's
the CrossFit world, but we're not going to get into that. But whenever we got into the physical therapy world, there was there's a lot of PTs doing very similar things to Joey and I with our personal practices and who we treat. So in the same way that, you know, normalizing a movement that's been painful, we're trying to normalize the idea that everybody can lift weights and be pain free, you know?
Yeah.
What were you going to say, Joey?
Well, I didn't, like, you kind of mentioned it. I'm like, are we going on this route? Because when I started PT school, I remember you have to get so many hours. And I remember somebody came in that was, you know, an athlete, and I don't remember if they were in a CrossFit. I think so. But they were, you know, a higher end athlete, and the PT was just sort of like blew it off that like, oh, you're beyond PT, go see a trainer. But at the same time, trainers were like, didn't really know what to do. So then you have a whole bunch of athletes are in this no man's land in between, that both ends are saying you're the other person's job to deal with. And then they're just sort of out on their own. And then Now I think what Will was really saying is now, you know, the newer version of physios like us are like, no, we're encapsulating all this because we were on the sports end and we went down the therapy end, and we're finally able to actually bridge that gap. And I think so many people have said they were bridging that gap, but I think as a whole, like, you'd have some people here and there, but a lot of people really didn't know how to really bridge it. And it was, they were just too distinct.
I mean, it's interesting that you say that, because I, when I was, God, how old was I? I think I was 19. I tore my ACL, LCL, MCL, and PCL playing soccer.
At the same time?
Same, like, obliterated, like, it was all just dust.
What did you do? Like, did you get hit by a car? Like, did a car drive onto the field and hit you?
So it was a combination of, I had planted, I was going to shoot a goal, and I had planted down on my right leg, was kicking with my left. So I was twisting, I was pivoting in towards the goal, and then I got completely
cleaned. Oh, God.
Like, you know that horrible stuff that you see in football games where, like, they love to show that stuff in slow-mo?
Like the running back for South Carolina a few years ago?
That stuff just turned – like, I can't watch it because I have
– But that dude was the unhappy triad, and it was
– I can't watch it either.
Usually the PCL remains intact in those instances, but you – they took out everything.
Everything.
It was like a knife sliced through your knee joint.
When I had the MRI, you could see stuff was flapping in the breeze. It was wild. But I was actually overseas at the time. I was in Denmark. And so I had to wait a hot minute until I returned back to the States to get it looked at, to get my MRI and all that stuff. But the PT that I had post-op for that was very – I could tell that he was really just sort of – he seemed very risk averse for a while.
Mm-hmm.
He didn't want me loading anything. I was completely non-weight bearing for a very, very long time. And I know that the surgery has changed, right? That was when I was 19 years old. So I was very young. I'm 38 now. That was half a lifetime ago.
Yeah.
But he was very hesitant to sort of release me to trying more difficult exercises. When I felt I was physically capable of doing so, he was very opposed to doing that. And with injuries that I've had more recently in the physical therapist that I was going to here locally in Raleigh, he really was a huge advocate of continuing to move and continuing to move through everything and just sort of relearn the way that I was moving incorrectly, but still loading things. So I found the approaches to be different, although I know that the injuries themselves are quite different. I'm sure there's different considerations you'd have to take for somebody who completely destroyed their entire knee joint versus just having a shoulder impingement or something. But, you know, I'm comparing it because it was those seem to me like the old school doctors and the old school way of doing
things,
school physical therapists. and then the sort of new wave of people that have come through. And I appreciate and really like the fact that there are more and more physical therapists that I'm finding, like my physical therapist in Raleigh and like you guys, who help people to continue to move. I mean, that's an important component of it. Is I feel like the knee-jerk response is always to say, okay, completely stop your activity, don't do anything,
take rest, 2 weeks off,
don't move. Yeah. And then like, and then before you know it, you're in a worse, like your pain is worse, you're more stiff, you can't move, and it almost feels like you have regressed from the first time that you actually ever injured yourself.
Yeah. Yeah, we get that at least once a week with somebody who was previously told take 2 weeks off, and now it's 6 weeks later and they're still not getting better.
Or yeah, it was like they were told take a few weeks off and now it's 20 years later.
Yeah.
Because
yeah.
They totally stopped exercising. Right, and they gave up everything. And it's like, what?
I recently had a really terrible case of patellar tendinosis in the knee that I had obliterated. So it's not surprising. But I actually went to multiple people to take a look at it, because I didn't know if I had some sort of, I was worried that there was a tear, like if the pain was that bad. I faced the same thing. There were some people, mostly orthopedic doctors, who would tell me, okay, I want you to completely take a month off from everything involving knee flexion. We're not going to touch this for a month. And then I had other people who were more advocates of like continuing to move that knee joint through its full range of motion and sort of removing the load in terms of, you know, don't put 300 pounds on a back squat and try, you know, keep squatting that. Yeah. But introducing more like tempo squats and that kind of thing to just sort of rebuild and strengthen that patellar tendon. And I was back, I mean, it did take me a long time to rehab it, but I'm fully returned to sport now. Whereas I feel like if I had taken time off and just rested it, like I don't know, I feel like I'd still be rehabbing it at this point.
Was that recently?
Yeah, that was, so Worlds this past year in 2019, my pain was a legitimate 10 out of 10. Mm-hmm. That was even just like at rest. It's like it would wake me up at night from sleeping. It was excruciating. So right after Worlds, I did take about 2 weeks off from training just because my body was just like, we're done here. This is what happened to me. When you get old, you need to lift.
how long was your actual rehab? You said it was a while, but like an idea wise.
Like how long did it take me to rehab the thing from start to finish?
Like six months.
I started, I diligently started rehab in September, and I just returned to sport late the month before last. I was still sort of working my way through some exercises as I returned to sport. And I was rehabbing it before I took that 2 weeks off too. So I sort of count that time as well, even though I was still, you know, squatting, cleaning, snatching, all that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
So it was a very long road. And that injury is one that I never wish on anybody. That is a horrible.
It's a doozy. Yeah. Yeah. A legit tendinopathy, tendinosis is going to take
usually takes around, about 3 months. Yep. But if it's chronic, it'll take longer.
Yep.
Yeah.
So
a chronic one will typically take more like in the 6 month range.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And that sort of, because I was looking up all kinds of stuff on, you know, how to sort of, you know, do your sort of self rehab. I mean, part of my rehab was actually I was kind of testing different rehab protocols on myself just to kind of mm-hmm. see how they would do. And everything that I was looking at was saying a minimum of like 4 to 6 months. And that's if you're lucky. And then you have to continue to do all of those rehab exercises. Like I still do them every single week as part of my, part of my leg day.
Yeah. You know, it's one of those things when looking at rehab and when you have athletes, especially somebody that's still trying to perform, you know, at a high level and they're no longer 18 when you can recover like this. Right. But one thing I'll tell people is don't confuse rehabilitated with asymptomatic. Just because you don't feel it does not mean it's done. Like you need to be looking at tests and measures to see what control you have, how much weight you can push through it, how much load it can handle. That is what signifies rehabilitated and not just the lack of pain. And likewise, I'll and I know Will does the same thing. We'll tell people you might be out of pain in the next couple of weeks or the next month, but you know, this is a longer process. Yeah. So
no, that's
good that you're finding out.
That's important for me to hear too, because there'll be days that I'll be completely pain free, and I'm like, let's load up the bar and do something stupid. And like, I have to constantly remind myself that, yeah, this, you know, everything that I've seen about patellar tendinosis, it's, you almost have to treat it like a lifetime thing. Like you always have to do some sort of something to kind of keep on top of the health and the strength of that tendon over the lifetime of your sport. And I feel like, especially for something like weightlifting, where like all you do is squat, right? Like everything is knee flexion. So it's going to be one of those things that I'm going to have to be diligent about it and stay on top of it if I don't want it to come back. Because I know that my pain is not necessarily an indicator of whether or not it's truly, truly gone.
Yeah. I read a lot of interesting studies years ago for somebody who's had an ACL tear, because I actually tore mine. I never ended up having surgery on it.
Tore mine as well.
Did you?
I tore my right one in 2013 doing a push jerk, a hop forward. Only the ACL. It was like a sniper sniped my fucking ACL.
I think mine was about 2013 as well. I wasn't doing anything fun. I was in the middle of the night with a bunch of friends who happened to be drinking. I was not, being the smart one, and we were out in a field. And I had a flashlight and I saw a ditch. So I turned around to tell everybody, hey, there's a ditch. And my buddy was right behind me and I didn't realize he was that close. And he pushed me. And as I was turning, the way I landed, it just.
Oh, yeah, you know, not fun. Most of the people that I met when I was rehabbing my ACL, PCL, all that jazz, they were freak injuries. Like there was one woman who she jumped over her sofa to go answer her phone. And like the landing, the way that she landed from jumping over the sofa, she just destroyed her ACL. It's just so funny how quick of an injury that can be just doing normal everyday stuff.
Most ACL injuries are non-contact at this point the trend that they're finding.
Do you remember that meme you had of that girl that like kicked her leg up, brought it down, and then it hyperextended and she tore her ACL?
Yes.
It just made me think of it. You know what I'm talking about?
At the college game day one.
Yeah.
Dude.
Have you seen it? Do you know what we're talking about?
I do. Yeah.
It was one of my older memes.
I think everybody has seen that. Yeah, it just made me think of that.
I saw that originally on Barstool and I was like, yep.
Yeah, I dropped my phone.
This is a football
when
season.
It happened. I freaked out.
You like threw it?
No, I just dropped it and was like, I can't watch injuries anymore. Like on ESPN when they show, I can't, because I instantly think of what's happening at the tissue level, how many months they're going to be out, what all they're going to go through. I can't watch an injury anymore. It's so hard.
Yeah. I still have a weird relationship with the dark side of seeing those things. I don't know. I can watch it. I also follow like, Nature is gnarly.
Dude, that
nature is metal.
Yes, I follow that page too. It is.
Some days it's just too much for my little heart to handle.
I gotta check it out.
It is.
Nature is gnarly.
There's no like emotion in how animals kill animals. Nope. Like they don't give a shit. It's, yeah. it's unethical to say the least. but okay, so refocusing. Whenever we were talking about who you worked with, I was interested to ask the question, what do you feel like is a common trend that, you know, we talk about how Joey and I talk a lot about how most people are all the same. No matter what they do in life, and they typically have the same fears, same goals, kind of across the board at its base level. What between all the different variability of people that you and your husband work with, what is a common trend that you see when dealing with them
whether it be things that they struggle with from a compliance issue, things that you you've figured out that works really well across the board. What are some of those things?
So I could, man, I could talk forever about some of this stuff, but
what's your favorite to talk about?
So one of the things that we have noticed, and there is a difference between the sexes, and there actually is some decent research out there on this, where if you give a client a program and you don't, let's say you don't prescribe weights, which we rarely ever do. I will prescribe weights for my weightlifters sometimes, and Alan will do hit for his powerlifters. But for
you mean like weights to hit in a set?
Yeah. So like,
versus a percentage.
Exactly. So okay. I'll give some of my weightlifters, a specific number that they need to hit on a specific lift or a specific exercise. But my bodybuilders, I likely won't do that. So like if I've programmed a bench press for somebody and I'll say do five sets of three reps, I usually don't assign a weight to that. Because most of these people have never established a one rep max or a three rep max or a five rep max or really anything that I can use to get any decent percentages off of. So what we do is we just give them that rep range that we want them to adhere to. We give them a tempo, we give them their rest intervals. And what we find is the females will often undershoot how much they are capable of lifting, and the men always overshoot, which I feel like is not surprising. But it's one of the things with women is they're very fearful of failure, and they're very fearful of failure, especially in a public and social setting like a gym. So they're afraid of either getting pinned under a bar or having to stop their set, mid rep, even though nobody knows how many reps they're being assigned. So nobody really knows that they're failing.
Yeah.
But the other part of that is most females don't really understand true muscle fatigue and exhaustion. So if I've given somebody a set of 10, they'll get to maybe rep 7 or 8 and start to feel a little bit tired, not really that much, get to 9, feel a little bit more tired, get to 10, be able to get that 10th rep out just fine, and then stop, and then they won't increase the weight for their next set of exercises. So they're not great at really pushing that limit and really understanding what true muscle fatigue and failure feels like.
Yeah.
And it's very difficult to convey that to somebody who has never felt it. And a lot of times for my females, I'll tell them, like, at some point, I actually want you to fail. I want that muscle to be so completely exhausted that you physically cannot lift the weight for another rep. You need to know what that actually feels like. And then men are the opposite. They will load up the bar with 315 pounds on a 5x10 bench press and think that they can do it. And it's like, no.
So are you saying that's specific, just for context, that's specific to not well-trained female athletes? Or
no,
have you seen it in well-trained female athletes?
Even in well-trained. And I don't know if it is because of the, like I said, the sort of social implications of failure.
Yeah.
Or if it's really that they just don't like to be physically uncomfortable when they're lifting. I don't know that, and I don't know where the gap is. This is one of the things that I sometimes struggle with my female clients, is describing to them what that's going to feel like, because it's different for every single person. But I've reached muscle failure so many times that I know when I'm doing, a snatch, if I'm doing a 7x2, I know roughly what weight I'm going to start to fail. But I'll know when I can push through that. It's amazing to me how many people just don't have that comfort with being uncomfortable and failing.
Yeah. Joey, what you got? I see your wheels turning.
they're always turning. I really, that brought me back to, I don't know if I would have known how to really push to failure had I not had the bodybuilding background.
Yeah.
Because with so much of that is so much about really beating a muscle down, getting the hypertrophy, really getting the contraction, getting the pump, so much of that is by getting to that high, red line, right? You're not redlining, but you're up there. You're like at that orange position, And the athletes I've worked with, they don't know that. My wife, she does, like, she's into fitness, but like she cannot get anywhere close to what she can really tolerate. And sometimes it's a mental block, and sometimes she's a form Nazi. She's a therapist as well. So like, if she doesn't have good technique, she's like, I'm not going beyond it. But I'm like, eh, sometimes you can sort of give and take one for the other, you know, if you need to break past a barrier, so right. long as you work within it and then correct the technique, and you know what I mean?
Yeah.
But that really goes back to the foundation, and because it is a mental game at that point too. And to me, the mental game really came from dieting. If you can master dieting, pushing weights around is the easy part.
Well, and it especially comes into play for people who are trying to build. So when we have a client who is, mm-hmm. you know, they're unhappy with the way that they look, but they're pretty lean and they're pretty thin, they're just not seeing the muscular definition that they want to, that usually means that somebody needs to go into a caloric surplus and actually build a decent base of muscle, which takes, you know, it can take about a year, if not longer. And but builds are 100% about the intensity that you bring to every single workout in the gym. So if you are not nearing that point of exhaustion with every single set you perform, you may go through that entire 12-month period thinking that you're building all of this wonderful, glorious muscle. And then when it's time to cut, you realize that you haven't built anything. And a lot of that is not because of your program. It's not because of your diet. It's because you did not bring that intensity in the gym. And that in the online world is a huge struggle, because you can't be, I can't be in the gym with everybody every single day. I can't be pushing you to failure every single day and motivating you to push you to failure every day. And that is, you know, we've had some people that have built, they've spent that whole year building, and I'll be talking to them in their bi-weeklies about their intensity. And I'm like, you know, you should be probably like 1 to 2 reps away from failure at every single set. And they're like, yeah, I'm doing it. And then they cut down and they look like they have not built anything. And
I know exactly what you're talking about.
Their intensity in the gym. And it's very hard to convey that if you're not there with them.
Yeah. I know from personal experience, I'm from Ohio. And so in Ohio, you know, it's cold 9 months out of the year. So it's very common that, you know, come the winter, everybody bulks up, right? You have bulking season. And then after that,
nine-month bulking season.
Pretty much, right? But you shed like your weight, bear. You know, it pretty much starts in like right after, you know, Valentine's Day is when people start, right? You know, they're 6 week, 10 week, 12 week, whatever. And every year it was like nothing happened, and it was like moderate. And then finally this one year I'm like, all right, I'm going to get a nutrition coach to help me with shredding. Cause I'm like, it can't be the intensity. I was always a hard gainer. It was really hard for me to gain weight. Mm-hmm. So I used this guy, and I hated him because he did a good job, that when I was actually done with the cut, I was smaller than when I originally started. So I said, oh, hell no. I was like, this is stupid. And then the next year I had that realization that I'm like, okay, I got to really be pushing, and I had to be really putting in calories. I was eating over 6,000 calories a day, or I was losing weight, and it was insane. Because I actually got to a point where I was actually putting on mass, real mass, and it was almost a job. But I had to actually hit high intensities, or all those calories were not going to the benefit. And then I actually hired him again, and then I actually saw the results. But you definitely have to, you know, put in that intensity to see those changes.
Definitely.
So I would say, working with CrossFitters, a lot of them have the opposite problem of what you just talked about, where it's always redlining, and it's always being in a pile of muck on the ground once you finish your workout. Yep. So I think I was thinking about, you know, how, because I had, before I got into CrossFit and weightlifting, I was doing majority bodybuilding stuff. So, and it was just a lot of hypertrophy because I was figuring out when I was 18, right? So, I knew what hitting thresholds felt like. And it gave me a better idea of how to manage myself, you know, doing a Metcon or doing higher percentages, I feel like a good strategy to teach a trained or untrained person how to manage either reps in reserve or higher RPEs would be like submaximal bodybuilding movements to train that fatigue and just train the awareness of that stimulus, which I will say I haven't done in my own programming from like a purely bodybuilding, not just accessory work type stimulus in a hot minute. But now this conversation is making me want to get back into that.
My training is almost all reps in reserve at this point.
Yeah.
Especially for masters lifters, that auto-regulation is really important because we simply cannot handle the volume, the same amount of volume at all as our younger counterparts. You know, our recovery takes a lot longer. The reps within the sets themselves, like, you know, when I first started weightlifting, I was still sort of following the programming of somebody who was 25 and I was 35 and I'm like, I feel like shit every day. Why is this? And it's because my volume was just, it was so high that I, you know, if I did a super high volume day on Monday and then followed it up with another super high volume squat day on Tuesday, I was incapacitated until Friday. Like that's just kind of, that was my reality for a while. So my coach, I will say, he's really good at working with me on my programming and we've really sort of switched over to a more RPE or reps in reserve type of training. He'll give me weight targets of, you know, this week, this is roughly where you should be. And so there are some weeks where I maybe don't hit those targets that he gives me, although I will personally feel like I've kept within the RPE that he has assigned. And there are some weeks that the RPE may be a little bit lower, not necessarily a deload, because I still do value those deload weeks. But let's say, for example, that I have a week where it's supposed to be like 80 to 85% and I'm feeling really good that week, then I might go 90, 95% because the next week I might feel like trash and have to go back down to like 75, 80%.
So you ride the wave.
Lets me sort of auto-regulate as I see fit. But I'm obviously a very seasoned and advanced lifter. So I know what that feels like and I know how to do that. But reps in reserve has been, Alan and I have found that really has been what has resonated with a lot of people. If you tell them, okay, by the time you get done with this set, you should feel like you could eke out maybe 3 more reps or 5 more reps or 1 more rep. People are really good at using that as a as a gauge for really how hard they should be pushing versus an RPE. I mean, it's different RPE versus reps in reserve. People tend to make that connection much better with reps in reserve than they do with RPE, because RPE, they will still try to assign a number to it. So if you tell somebody your RPE is 7 this week, they'll say, oh, 70%. And they'll still try to assign that number. Versus understanding an RPE of 7, you should have about 3 reps left in reserve. They don't think about it the same way.
Yeah,
that's what we've noticed. I work really close with the powerlifting gym here, and the whole gym switched to reps in reserve. And I actually hadn't seen it really pick up in weightlifting until very recent. But I've been seeing it in powerlifting for the past couple of years. Now, in that defense, I'm also much more in the powerlifting realm than the weightlifting realm. I'm starting to see it turn around more, but that I think could be just because I'm getting into it more. But I really do like the reps in reserve a lot better. Like you mentioned, I saw the exact same thing. If you give somebody and you prescribe an RP of 7 or 8, they don't really know, especially if they're brand new. Yeah. But if you say, hey, leave 2 like in the tank, like 2 clean reps.
Yep.
And then I don't know if you do any like 7.5 RIR or do just the whole integers? Yeah.
For less experienced lifters, I just do whole. But for my more experienced ones, I might do half. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. It's, and part of it's with learning your client and your athlete, and which is where training becomes so much more fun when you already have a good solid 6 months with somebody, and the longer the better. Right. Yep. And I'm sure you've seen the same thing.
Yep.
Yeah.
And because I have some lifters where I do reps in reserve, I have some where I do more of an RPE, and then I have some where I will straight up assign them weights. Because I have some people who, even if I give them a rep in reserve or an RPE, they undershoot all the time. And then when they go to test, you know, there are sometimes that I will have people before a meet, you know, test openers and that kind of thing. And they'll be way under what I would expect them to be. And it's because they haven't pushed throughout their entire 12-week cycle. They've been lowballing it the whole time. And so for those people, I have found that you have to assign weights to them. But those are typically the younger, less experienced lifters that can sort of handle the heavier weights when they need to be handled. They have that ability. So yeah. It's usually my younger lifters where I'm assigning actual weights to them.
Gotcha.
Lucky bastards.
Beth, I know we're getting close to the end of the hour. Do you need to go right at the end of the hour?
No, I've got I think my next meeting isn't until like 1 or something like that.
Okay. We won't talk that long.
Very easily could.
Yeah. So, okay. We talked a little bit about, well, that was a little bit of what you struggle with as well as what you found to work most. What's another struggle either that you've overcome with clients or that you're currently in the midst of figuring out?
So one of the things that I do struggle with, and we touched upon this a little bit earlier, is just sort of people's perception of pain. Everybody's perception of their own pain is different. What I may consider a 10 out of 10 with my knee, somebody else might consider a 5, and vice versa. Yeah. So I'll sometimes have clients that come to me that maybe have some sort of previous injury that has sort of flared up again with them. It's something that they have treated prior to me. It's an injury that occurred prior to me, but it sort of reared its head again. And I sometimes have difficulty understanding if it's something that I have programmed for them that has kind of pissed off this injury. And if so, if it is my doing and part of my programming, how to sort of amend that and what advice to give them to work through it. Cause I'm still not the best at really being able to cause I'm not a physical therapist, right? Like I can't diagnose, I can't put somebody through, you know, movement tests and that kind of thing. So sometimes when people present with injuries, I have a difficulty understanding if their pain is really what they say it is. Like if they're saying they're in excruciating pain, are you really? Mm-hmm. And then sort of how to continue to work through that while training. And then do I potentially need to amend my own programming if it is what has exacerbated their old injury?
So is this on the front end or in the middle of already programming for them?
It might be in the middle or towards the, like if they're on like a, let's say a 12-week cycle, like it might be more towards the middle or the end.
Okay. And you had usually been working with them a while before that?
Yeah.
This isn't like your initial intake?
Right. Yeah. This will be like a sort of a client that's been with me maybe for, you know, 6 months or something like that, where they've sort of had a resurgence of an old injury.
Gotcha.
How often do you look at your program and update it? Do you do it like a week by week, multi-week, or?
It does depend. So for people, especially people who are building, we typically run 12-week blocks. There's a lot of data behind really giving somebody a program and letting them run it for quite a bit of time versus changing it too frequently. My weightlifters, though, I run them on sort of 4-week cycles. So they'll stick with the same 4 exercises for a period of 4 weeks, but the loading, the weight increases. The weight and the volume will usually increase over the course of the 4 weeks, and then they deload. And then they'll switch again to another set of 4 exercises, and then they'll follow that sort of pattern for 12 weeks. So it's a whole mesocycle, and then it's sort of broken up within that mesocycle.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
So I would say on the front end, if one of these athletes that you are training, you know that they have a prior injury, that can kind of lead and steer the conversation as well as the programming. But it already sounds like you take into consideration prior injuries with programming.
If they tell me, like that's half the battle sometimes is, oh yeah, I hurt my shoulder 3 years ago. And sure. You know, like the first time I'm hearing about it.
Yeah. Yeah. So to some degree, so there's like there is a finesse with this whole kind of situation thing in the sense of
sometimes someone will not tell you something that's happened 3 to 5 years ago. I've had a lady tell me that she's hurt, her back has been hurting her since she was a flyer cheerleader in high school and she got dropped, which was like 19 years ago. And I'm like, okay, so you've had the same exact problem for 19 years. And she was like, yeah. And it's like, so was that, is that just your normal? And she was like, yeah. So to some degree, but in, and this is also situational in the sense that a lot of times the prior problem has already healed itself. They probably, it's not probably leading into the current situation. Sometimes it can, in the sense of, you know, a prior knee injury can sometimes lead into a predisposition for a certain problem. But having the knowledge and asking the right questions on the front end is always going to be the best base level. Like, so taking, we call it a, taking a more thorough subjective history, and the questions that you'll ask initially can kind of steer that. But in the middle of a programming cycle, if it's something that you kind of knew of and it's flaring up, but you've already covered your bases with programming, I would say, you know, Joey and I talk a lot about workload management and managing from a programming standpoint, not spiking load too much in that program. But when it does happen and an athlete doesn't handle it well and they're reporting painful symptoms, I typically, like, I don't downplay what the problem is. I just start to ask more questions surrounding that problem. So, like, what have you been doing outside the gym? Like, right. You might find out that it's a weightlifter that never does anything outside of weightlifting, and then they go on a quarantine walk for an hour and a half, and they haven't walked, they haven't just walked for an hour and a half in like 3 years, and then their knee hurts. Well, they
only weightlift.
Yeah, that's just too everywhere. Much. That's just too much too soon, right. From the specificity of that task, right? Which, right. Weightlifting does not prepare you for long duration walking, right? It makes your tissue strong, but to some degree, you know, the specificity of the task is going to drive if there's a breakdown in the task. So asking questions about that, as well as asking questions about how it affects their day. Is it specific to the lift, or is it bothering other things throughout the day? Is a good initial intake, but at the same time, setting boundaries for what these different painful situations mean for the weightlifting. So for instance, whenever you were going through your tendinosis, patellar tendinosis rehab, did your PT give you boundaries on how much discomfort was safe versus not?
Yeah, we worked within 6 to 7 was sort of the top of where he wanted me to stay with pain. Like if it exceeded 7, that meant I was pushing a little bit too hard. So we definitely did establish those boundaries.
Cool. Yeah. So that's a specific, that specific boundary has been found in the tendinopathy research. Joey and I apply that to most pains, right? And as long as it's, I typically say as long as it's not a sharp pain going over a 7, it's typically safe. But establishing the relationship with the patient on, you know, if it's not the sharp pain and it's not going over a 7 and you're able to do the task and your function's not decreasing and you see that they're not changing how they move, then it's typically relatively safe. And asking more questions about what they're feeling is also going to be super helpful. Now, from a trainer standpoint, I would say we get a lot of questions about pain because in the training educational realm, the the newer research on pain is still new to like healthcare providers, right? So it's probably even newer in the trainer domain, because most things like the NASM still talk a lot about like postural dysfunction, which is fine. But in our world, that's kind of like on its way out, if that makes sense. Yeah. So there's a lot of new stuff in the pain science world and talking about pain. I follow a few Pilates people in Australia where a lot of the pain science stuff is coming out of, that have been following the pain science researchers that are more aware of it and kind of speak that language, but it's still on the newer end here. So Joey and I talk about it a lot. It's really good stuff. But it's determining what they're feeling, recognizing it. And like you said, a 10 out of 10 for you might be a 5 out of 10 for someone else. That's a totally realistic problem to have explained to you, because it doesn't make it less real for that person's pain experience. Does that make sense?
Right. Yep.
So, but I would say from a training perspective, the rules that we use is usually, as long as it's not a sharp over 6 out of 10, as long as the pain isn't getting worse with each rep, and then it's not lingering too much, preferably not 24 hours over that training, or from the end of that training session to the next day, then it's typically safe.
Okay.
Or you're not doing more harm than good from a training stimulus standpoint. Does that make sense?
Yes, definitely. Well, that's great information.
Yeah. So, a lot of what you dealt with working through your own problem is based off the tendinopathy research, like we had talked about, but that can apply to a lot of other pains. Right. We preach stronger subjective intakes on the front end with people, just to give you a base of where their headspace is, because like you had mentioned for the female athletes that struggle with failure, and you said social, right? You said it's a social fear. To some degree, someone's pain experience could be altered based off of where they are socially. Like if they're training in a garage by themselves versus at the gym, the social aspect of being in the gym can affect their pain. It's not always biomechanical and it's not always programming related, you know? So there's a lot of different factors.
Yeah.
Yeah. But good stuff. That's a good question. We get that a lot. It's because there is so many different factors, I would say determining what you know from your relationship with the athlete and what they respond best to is going to be your best bet.
Right.
Pretty much every time. And you can play around with it. I mean, test and retest, but
right.
It's better to know like the big picture and then determine the little pieces that go into it for that specific athlete, right? Because different pieces can mean different things to different people,
right?
But it's a tough world to be in. But trainers get asked about what pains mean all the time.
Yeah.
From a trainer perspective, trainers spend way more time with people, or not for you, you're mostly online, and you said you do bi-weekly check-ins.
Yeah, every 2 weeks. Yeah.
Okay. So yeah, so you typically get more reps with people, or it's a little bit more high touch, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. That's good. Did that answer your question?
Yeah, no, there's a ton of great information in there. Yeah, that was awesome.
Cool. Sometimes I get on soapbox.
Oh, we can get on some crazy soapboxes. I think for all the listeners, because he did have a lot of really good info there, So to summarize it real quick, I think if you're a trainer, if you're a coach on and you're working with clients and you have somebody who has pain, we typically look at two different avenues. One, on the front end, see if maybe something they did, maybe it was too much for them. Maybe they weren't sleeping as well. Maybe they had something in their own lifestyle change. And then on the back end, on your end, go and look at your programming. Did maybe you have a spike in their programming that maybe it was an error on your behalf? And that's fine, because sometimes it's going to happen and you need to make adjustments. But what Will was really saying is, as I mean, he circumlocuted all the way around, because you really have to. You can't look at a one-sided standpoint. So you have to look at both sides. And that's really where it comes from. Take a look at both and see which area really needs more focus and question.
Yeah. And I'm always more than happy to, you know, I'll tell people, like, if it maybe was the increase in volume this week, like let's say it's a weightlifter, for example, that all of a sudden their shoulder is super pissed off, and it happened to coincide with a week where their volume went up, like that for sure could be what did it. And for those people, I'll immediately back off the volume and be a little bit more conservative with the approach, because we're talking about the long game here, right? Like, we want to still be lifting. We're 50 and 60 years old. Like, I don't care if you hit a PR in 3 weeks from now. Are you still going to be able to lift in 20 years? Or is my programming going to bury you in the dust and make you retire by the time you're 40? Because that's not what I want to do. And, you know, talking about sort of the longevity of clients, like obviously the longer you work with somebody, the better you get to know them, the better you understand how your programming impacts them. And then you can even change your approach with that singular person. Like my coach has done with me. I've gone off on a completely different tangent with Jared than when I first started. And he has really just taken me as an individual and looked at his programming template and has completely changed it for me, for my body, for my needs. And it's been a positive experience for me as a fellow coach to see that, because oftentimes we see these cookie cutter programs that are doled out to the masses that don't take into account training age, you know, physical age, prior injuries, all of that stuff. And you wonder why we have a pretty high injury rate in some of these sports like CrossFit, like weightlifting. We see it all the time. And it's because I think there's just too much like cookie cutter. Let's give one program to everybody and just see what happens. And that's really not how programming should be done, in my opinion.
Right.
Absolutely. I agree.
That's a dangerously long conversational soapbox. we'll save that one for the next one. Well, cool. Yeah. So wrapping up, Beth, where can people find you on the socials?
On the socials, on Instagram, my handle is bpbacon13. Our website is mauiathletics.com. And we also have an Instagram page for Maui Athletics, which is just at Maui Athletics.
Cool. Sweet. Well, thank you so much for hopping on.
No problem.
The next time we do this, it's going to be based out of Maui.
We're going to do a live podcast.
Y'all can come find me on the beach. Yeah, you can do a little tax write-off and write off.
I was about to say, it's definitely going to be business write-off.
Cool. That's right. There's loophole if you do it on Friday and Monday, right?
There you go.
So there you go. The whole weekend's right off. Let's do it.
Perfect.
Thank you so much for your time, Beth.
No problem. Thanks, guys.
Thank you.
Thank you.
If you're interested in connecting with us and other coaches around the world, just like you, on a more personal level, join our Facebook group, Alineate Coaches Community, linked in the episode description. Also, if you or a friend who is a trainer are interested in joining us in a podcast, shoot us a message after joining. We'd love to chat.